From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Robin, it seems like almost every month there is another deadline that Greece has to meet in order to avoid economic catastrophe. That is really weighing on young Greeks who are dealing with astronomical unemployment. We're going to speak with one in a few minutes who has had enough.
Well, meanwhile, Jeremy, Greek doctors and nurses and staff from state-run hospitals have had enough. They went on a 24-hour strike today to protest short staff and low pay. And this all comes as a Greek official says Greece will not be able to make an upcoming repayment to the International Monetary Fund unless a bailout deal is reached. Now, the creditors say Greece can't have that bailout money that the country's been given until they start reforming. But Greeks, as we are hearing, are balking. They're striking over those austerity reforms. John Saropoulos is an independent journalist living in Athens. His blog is The New Athenian. And John, it sounds like a vicious cycle. Creditors demanding reform, Greeks saying we can't cut anymore.
That's right. And this is the reason why the left-wing government, Syriza, came to power in late January. Their key promise was that they were going to reduce the amount of money that Greece was sending abroad to pay back its creditors and keep some more of that money at home. The government specifically wants to make about 1.2 to 1.5% of GDP available to its creditors, down from more like 3%. And that would keep a few billion dollars more in the economy, which Syriza says desperately needs reinvestment. I think that's the key reason why they were elected, because the one question their conservative predecessors, who were austerity-minded, could not answer was, what are you going to do about the fact that the debt is unsustainable and that the Greek economy, because it's not growing, cannot ultimately continue to make those payments?
And, John, just remind us, why is the Greek economy not growing? What was the problem at the root of this?
Well, at the beginning of the crisis, the general consensus was that the reason the Greek economy was shrinking was that it wasn't competitive. And while that is probably true, the answer is now more complicated than that. The International Monetary Fund came out with an ex post facto report in the summer of 2013 of its fiscal adjustment program for Greece. And in that report, it said that all the cost-cutting that it forced upon the governments of 2010 onwards actually contributed far more extensively than it had originally estimated to the shrinking of the economy.
This was the global debate at the time when all the countries were feeling the recession, spend or cut. Countries like the U.S. spent and pulled out of it. And as you say, the IMF is saying maybe there were too many cuts initially in Greece. But what happens now if Greece cannot make this repayment to the IMF? We understand the euro has already fallen on the news.
The finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, made it quite clear when questioned at the end of the last Eurogroup on May 11th that the amount of time that he believes Greece has at its disposal to complete its negotiation with creditors was 2 weeks. In other words, about a week before the end of May. This, I think, was his estimate of the time during which Greece could both pay salaries and pensions at home and service debt overseas. After the end of May, the government is going to have to choose salaries and pensions and default on its external debt. At least that is what it has said it's going to do if push comes to shove.
Well, there's still the possibility of those bailout funds being unlocked. Is there any chance of that so that Greece would have access to some of that money, even if it maybe hadn't enacted all the reforms that were tied to that money?
The original rubric of the negotiation, which was produced on February 20th, was precisely what you described, that there was going to be a sort of interim agreement at the end of April, which would be everything that was agreed upon between the government and its European partners, and that would be signed as a confidence-building measure and used as a springboard from which to then proceed to solve all the bigger and more contentious issues by the end of June. But it now seems that the Europeans are playing hardball, and they have basically forced a full and comprehensive agreement upon the Greeks without the interim stage, which means no early release of 7.2 billion euros with which Greece can keep going for a few weeks longer. And that means that the Greeks really, at the end of May, have got to make some very hard decisions about whether they're going to give in on the red lines, as they call them, of their government negotiation strategy, particularly deregulation of labor and reducing pensions, or whether they're going to go ahead and default on the external debt and stick to their red lines.
That's John Syropoulos, independent journalist living in Athens. His blog, again, is The New Athenian. John, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, one of the big problems in Greece is that Greeks are taking their money out of the country. Another is that Greek citizens are leaving in droves. More than 200,000 have left since the crisis began 5 years ago, many of them young. We're going to hear now from one of them. Alkestis Anagnostopoulou Merkouri is a 20-year-old student. She studies abroad in Paris, but she's back in Greece for the summer living in Athens. Alkestis, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and tell us a little more about yourself. You're a student right now, but you're also working.
I'm a student. I'm working as part of my bachelor's degree on political science, economics, and law, a little bit of everything. And next year, I will be studying economics and business.
And you grew up in Greece. How long have you been living in Athens?
I'd say 17 years, 18 years.
And what is it like now? How do you like it?
I don't like it very much. Hmm. I came back for an internship, and I regretted my decision, to be honest, because I can see the crisis, I can see the misery, the mentality of people, the everyday life, how they treat each other. People are getting angry. They're in the streets. They're fighting with each other. When everything is going well and when people have money, it's usually very, very nice. But now things are not going very well. We have many demonstrations. Student unions occupy the universities. Students cannot go and study. So it's been a bit chaotic, I would say.
And as we know, the unemployment rate there for young Greeks is at 50%. Do your friends...
Yeah.
Work, those who have stayed in Athens?
I don't have a lot of friends who have stayed. All of them are pretty much in the U.S. and the U.K., so we're good at the moment. Yeah.
So it doesn't sound like you're somebody who's going to stay in Greece once you can finally leave.
Not really. I'm planning to stay somewhere in Europe wherever I can find a job because, to be honest, things are getting harder and harder also in other European states. Belgium, France, unemployment rate is rising as well.
But the situation in those countries is not nearly as bad economically as it is in Greece right now. What do you think is the problem? Why do you think Greece is in such a bad situation?
Well, we are obsessed by the debt, how big the debt is, whether we will be able to repay the debt. So in my opinion, this is not the problem. The problem is our economy and the fact that we're not producing anything. This, I will give you an example. It will shock you. You know, of course, the delicious, famous Greek dish, souvlaki.
Yeah.
With gyros, of course. Yeah, even the meat for the souvlaki, the gyros, is imported. We're not... producing almost anything. Just we're importing oranges, lemons. We only have olive oil. All we care about is not all we, but the government. All we care about is our public servants, who are not efficient, by the way, and the pensioners. The public sector, where development, innovation, and employment is coming from, is completely ignored. So I think the problem is our political system.
But you're going to have a degree in political science soon. Don't you feel any interest in coming back to Greece and trying to solve these problems?
I'm pretty pessimistic. I don't think the problem can be solved by the politicians. I think the problem can be solved only through education and through the mentality of people. So everyone says that Greeks are corrupt, and this is true, I would say. It's shocking, but corruption is everywhere. If we don't change our mentality, if we don't change the way we see the economy, and because our economy is pretty much a Soviet model, And this is shocking. Everything is reviewed by the state. So it's been almost 4 months and the government hasn't done a single thing. It hasn't made any necessary reform, of course, except for enforcing nepotism and bureaucracy. And I think this is part of our mentality. It's not going to change if we don't change as a people.
So given all of that, what would you like the government to do right now with regards to the current crisis?
Listen to what the Europeans have to say. Listen to the IMF, the Troika. They've made some mistakes. We have made some mistakes. I think there has to be a true discussion, a useful discussion, a fruitful discussion, and we have to find a solution. We have to start making reforms now, right now, because in a few days we're going bankrupt. We have no money.
Well, Alcestis, thank you so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
He has already swum across the Atlantic, and now 47-year-old Ben LeCompte wants to become the first person to swim across the Pacific. He takes off in July from Tokyo, and he joins us now from Dallas. Ben, there are going to be a lot of challenges on your journey, including you're going to be swimming right through the Great Pacific Garbage Patch.
Well, that is the focus and the purpose of the swim, is to swim through it and to show what is in the middle of the ocean to everybody, because we'll have live streaming and also engage on social media, so everybody on land will be able to be part of the expedition. And swimming and following the current will bring me in those area, very dense area with a microplastic.
And is that dangerous?
There is a misconception about these garbage patches. People think that it's an island, plastic island you can step on. It's absolutely not that. It's microplastic found there in very high concentration and creates a lot of problem for the ecosystem, because what you see, it's on the surface of the water, it's only 15% of the plastic. The other 15% is on the water column. And 70%, the rest of it, it's already at the bottom of the ocean.
What about the Great White Shark Migration Zone that you're going to be going through as you approach San Francisco?
Yeah, that's always a good point of discussion when I talk about shark and the one that followed me for 5 days in the Atlantic. You know, that's their environment, so I'm not going to jump in the middle of sharks that are just waiting to get fed. I have a lot of different devices that keep them at bay. People there also to monitor. I don't have any death weight. You know, I used to ride a motorcycle in Paris. I used to ride a motorcycle in Dallas. And there is more risk riding a motorcycle in those cities than swimming in the middle of the ocean.
Still, the idea of going head-to-head with a great white shark might be a little more scary to some people than riding a motorcycle in Paris.
Yeah, but in extreme situation, you can even deploy a net around me that will keep me safe.
You mentioned your swim across the Atlantic. This swim is 2,000 miles longer than that.
Yes, that's the big blue, right? The Pacific. So right after I finished the Atlantic, my first words were never again. And then shortly after that, 2 months or so, I was already thinking about the next one.
Why? And what changed?
Well, when you just finish something that is very very challenging and you are in pain, you just want to rest and not think about it. But when it is a passion, then the passion is there. No matter what you do, it's still going to be there. And for me, what is important right now, it's the motivation behind it, because my first priority is my children and their future. And I want to use the swim to get the attention about those issues that are very important for the next generation to come, sustainability and how we discard of plastic and so on. So I want to do my part and try to use my passion as a catalyst for that.
How are you training for this?
I do a lot of different aerobic exercise. So I run, I ride a bicycle, and I swim. I try not to swim too much because I don't want to lose that passion. And especially here in Dallas, I don't have the ocean. So when I swim, it's mostly in the pool. It's pretty boring to me. So I try to not do too much of that, but I train between 3 to 5 hours, about 5 to 6 days a week.
Is it all freestyle, or do you think during your swimming across the Pacific you'll switch into breaststroke and butterfly and do a little backstroke?
No, I do all freestyle, yeah. Yeah, once you are in the routine, especially when it's a long haul like that, you dissociate your mind from your body. Your body becomes on autopilot, and you do the same thing over. It's almost like asking a person who is doing a ultra marathon to start running backwards. You know?
This is making me feel that my 200-meter individual medley relay was really not that much. It seemed like a lot of the time.
No, the challenges are there in every type of event and swim that you do. It's just a different type of challenge. People are asking me, oh, do you plan on swimming the English Channel? I say, well, no, because when I swim, I have fins on, I have a wetsuit, I use a snorkel, and it's different, totally different from what the people who are crossing the English Channel are using. You know, just swimming in that 17 degrees Celsius water for 10 hours without a wetsuit, you need to be very prepared. Very, very challenging.
No wetsuit?
No wetsuit for those people. If you want to be following
You'll
the
have
English
a wetsuit,
channel,
though, right?
Yes, I will.
Yes.
I will. Oh, yes. Yes.
It's going to be cold in that water.
It is going to be cold, especially when I arrive close to the U.S. coast. The water drops, you know, in the 50s, high 50s, low 50s, depending on the time of the year. So I have different, multiple layers of bodysuit around my upper body.
What do you eat on the journey? Is it seafood only, or...?
No, you try to stay away from that. You have that salty, nasty taste in your mouth for so long, so seafood is out of the question. But when I am in the water, so it's basically liquid and electrolyte or a soup type of food. And the real thing is that when I am on the boat, that's when I eat, because I have to consume about 8,000 calories per day. And I cannot eat that during the day when I swim. So when I am on the boat, I have big meals. And even during the night, I wake up because I am hungry. So I just eat and then go back to bed and sleep a few hours and wake up again and eat to ingest those 8,000 calories. And it's mainly, you know, pastas and rice and canned food.
So not the South Beach diet.
No. And You are very easy, you know. When you are when you swim 8 hours, you can eat anything. So, but I am in a no sugar diet.
What are you thinking of while you're swimming?
Well, it's a very important element, because you need to have your mind prepared for it, and you need to know what you are going to do with your mind when you swim. So I have an entire schedule of 8 hours, knowing what I am going to think about and what I am going to be doing with my mind when I swim. So it's almost like a kid going to school, where the first hour they are going to have a math class, and then after English and so on. So I do the same thing, an hour block of subject that I'm going to get my mind involved in, thinking about the past or visualizing new things. So it's a schedule that I have each morning before I go in the water.
And how do you keep track of the time as you're doing that? How do you decide, okay, 1 hour has expired, I can stop thinking about one of my favorite childhood birthday parties, and I'm going to move on to something else now?
Yeah, what I do, I'm being fed every 20 to 30 minutes. So I know that each time I've been fed twice, it's about an hour, and that's how I count.
Do you sing in your head at all? We talked to Diana Nyad, who, of course, swam across from Cuba to Florida, and she said she used to sing songs over and over in her head.
Yes, I do that. Some of the exercises are math exercises or singing, but I try to change every hour because I cannot be singing for 8 hours.
That's Ben LeCompte, who is hoping to become the first person to swim across the Pacific, all the way from Japan to San Francisco. He's going to take off in July. Ben, good luck to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, tonight is the end of the David Letterman reign. And just a quick thought now on the beginning. A million years ago, okay, it was 1980, a visionary named Fred Silverman at NBC proposed a new idea, hinge programming, and Dave and I were to be the hinges. The idea was that I'd host a morning show, he'd come on the end of that, and then I'd appear at the top of his show, which was already on the air. I said, Dave, let's do a bit where you introduce me to New York. And he did, introducing me to every single person on the street outside 30 Rock. Here's a little.
Excuse me. Did you meet Robin
Hi.
Young? She just got in from Boston.
How are you?
What is your name?
It's so nice of you to take the time. I know you're really busy.
Oh, I got nothing to do.
If you host a low-rated morning talk show,
you got plenty of time.
When you're the host of the lowest-rated morning talk show, turns out Dave's morning show lasted just 18 weeks. Can you imagine David Letterman's dry wit at 9 a.m.? Anyway, my show never even started. I went to the Today Show. NBC paid Dave a reported $20,000 a week to do nothing for a year because there was nowhere to put him. The Johnny Carson Show owned Late Night. I'd visit Dave in exile in his neighboring office, empty except for pencils, which we'd practice throwing into the ceiling. He, of course, eventually hosted a show that followed Carson's at NBC, but then another huge disappointment. When Carson left, NBC famously gave that slot to Jay Leno. Of course, Dave made his way to CBS and into television history. I guess it's just a reminder that before the age of the internet and YouTube, if you didn't have the right gatekeeper, you didn't get the gig. And a reminder, too, that David Letterman almost didn't happen. So if you're at this moment tossing pencils into the ceiling, wondering why no one gets you, take heart. And congratulations, David Letterman. It's here now. At the height of the oil boom, less than a year ago, it was not uncommon for a company to pay more than $10,000 an acre to drill on state land in North Dakota's Bakken oil field. But since oil prices have crashed, so has that windfall. As Emily Guerin reports, recent state mineral auctions in North Dakota have seen the lowest prices since the 2007 boom.
I couldn't have asked for a better guide to the North Dakota state mineral auction than Tom Gray.
I'm so excited about this radio thing.
So excited, he needs to take a selfie with me immediately.
You want the microphone?
Yeah, let me put the microphone up here.
Okay.
Gray is old enough to be my grandfather. He's from Texas, but he's been working the Bakken oil field since 2009 as a land man, a broker who helps oil companies purchase rights to drill oil wells.
So let me show you what we're doing today.
Yeah, show me what we're doing today.
Okay.
Gray unfolds a map of the Bakken. He's highlighted areas that are up for bid today. Before oil companies can start drilling on state lands, they need to sign a lease with the state. And before they sign a lease, they need to outbid everyone else in this room for the right to drill. It's called a bonus.
60, 65.
We're at the state capitol in Bismarck, and the room is filled with about 40 guys and two women. They catch the eye of the auctioneer by lifting their finger or flicking a pen. Gray is on the phone with his client.
575, are we in?
He's in. The bonus that he's bidding on is a one-time per-acre payment that's like a big thank you to North Dakota for allowing drilling on state lands. When that bonus rose above $1,000 an acre, Gray shook his head.
We're out.
By the end of the auction, the state had made $1.8 million in bonus payments. That's about eight times less than the auction in May of last year. Drew Combs oversees these auctions as head of the state Minerals Management Division. He says this is the first real dip in bonus payments since the oil price slide.
I expected it. I just hard pill to swallow, I guess.
The other reason for the drop in bonus payments? Most of the parcels auctioned off today weren't as good as those for sale a year ago. Combs calls these parcels
goat pasture. That means it doesn't have a lot of prospect to it.
Goat pasture. Stuff on the margins of the Bakken. When oil prices are high, companies will take a chance on goat pasture. When prices are low, they won't. But companies will still spend a ton on parcels in the sweet spot of the Bakken. A few months ago, I sat next to Drew Combs during the last few minutes of an online auction.
This is very stressful.
Combs was hitting refresh every 20 seconds. It was a bidding war between two small companies. And then...
Nope, Continental.
Oh my goodness.
Slid in there and bought their well. Slick.
Continental Resources is one of the biggest oil companies in the Bakken, and they hadn't even made a bid until the last 7 seconds. They ended up paying a bonus of over $14,000 per acre, almost a record high for the state. Compare that to the average of $76 an acre paid for the goat pasture. I asked oil and gas analyst Stephen Trammell with IHS Energy what his takeaway was.
The companies know that demand will come back and that oil will start to recover over time.
And until then, if you're willing to take a risk, goat pasture is going for real cheap at the North Dakota mineral auction. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Guerin.
And Emily's story comes to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. You're listening to Here and Now. Former President Jimmy Carter cut short an election monitoring visit to Guyana this month because of health concerns. Now, anytime a president isn't feeling well, it raises eyebrows. But in this case, equally eyebrow-raising for many was the reminder that Jimmy Carter is 90. When did that happen? And how much globetrotting is he doing? Jimmy Carter has now lived longer after leaving office than any other president, so we thought we'd bring in Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, for a look at Carter's living legacy. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We should say that Jimmy Carter has since said that he feels just fine. But this sent a little, sort of alarm through many of us. How about you?
Of course. Anytime we hear that from a former president, especially someone who's remained so active and such a public presence in not only the U.S. but all over the world, we have feelings of concern and fear.
Right. And well, we're suddenly struck, though, with how much traveling he has done. Guyana is the 100th country where his Carter Center has monitored elections since it was formed in 1989. That's 9 years after he left office, a one-term presidency. You believe that Jimmy Carter sort of recast what a post-presidency looks like. Tell us more.
I really do. I think, you know, there were different models for what a president could do. Certainly, they could continue to advise future presidents off the record. They might make some public appearances for their party, at least in the modern era. But he did something bigger. He created a center, which was a base of diplomacy and political influence. And that, combined with several books, made him a very active, a proactive figure on the public stage, from everything from elections to offering ideas about the Middle East.
Well, I was just going to say that's been controversial. He's very critical of the U.S. and Israel when it comes to Palestinians.
Hugely controversial. You know, Carter, one thing we know about him is once he was freed from the presidency, he was willing to say what was on his mind. And there are many people who feel that in some issues, he comes down on one side of the debate rather than in a diplomatic role of trying to mediate things. And so in the Middle East, this has been his biggest area of controversy, with many supporters of Israel feeling he's not, you know, working on a peace in the area so much as taking the side of the Palestinian point of view. So that's been a source of controversy.
Yeah, and just to remind us how he exited office and how he maybe entered it, you know, elected in 1976 after Watergate, a humiliating time for many Republicans. But put that in context. I mean, what was his term like?
Well, he entered with great hope. I mean, he runs in 1976 as the guy you can trust again. And Americans are disillusioned with government. They don't believe anything after Richard Nixon. And he offered them for a while hope that politics could be different. 4 years later, it was a disaster. Foreign policy turned against him. The economy seemed to be – it was struggling. And he was an incredibly unpopular president. And many Democrats were as happy as Republicans when he left office. So a few imagined that in the next few decades, he would remain so active and become such a force on the political scene. But it was a difficult presidency.
Well, let's listen to, though, the hope at the beginning. This is part of his acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention in New York.
It's time for us to take a new look at our own government, to strip away the secrecy, to expose the unwarranted pressure of lobbyists, to eliminate waste, and always to remember that in any town or city, the mayor, the governor, and the president represent exactly the same constituents.
So there is that at the beginning of the presidency, and we remember after he was sworn in, he and his wife, Roslyn, stopped their limousine, got out, walked during the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue. This is a symbol of his desire to be, you know, of the people. But, well, what is – have historians yet – historians like you yet decided what was the biggest problem with his presidency? Because he does have supporters who say the hostage situation in Iran would have robbed any president of popularity.
Well, there's something to that. Obviously, that was a terrible crisis for international relations and just for the morale of the U.S. But I think there's other problems. You know, one that historians like to talk about is that he never got along with congressional Democrats very well from the start. And you could hear it in the speech you just played. Not only was he promising to restore faith in government, he was as willing to go after his own party and the interests that supported his party as he was the Republicans. So many congressional Democrats like Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, really didn't like him. And they felt that he was not a Democratic president. And I think that many historians would say ultimately undermined what he was or was not able to do. He also chose issues that didn't have a lot of political payoff. So he did deal with energy and the environment, but those were not issues in the middle of a horrible economic situation that many Americans wanted to focus on.
Well, he famously wore sweaters and turned down the heat in the White House. And Americans were saying, wait a second. And this is when they were queuing up to – you know, long lines to get gas at gas stations. Again, the Middle East was in turmoil, and the I think this is when the hostage situation was going on, or no?
Yeah, the second oil shock is in 1979. His first speech is actually in 77 on energy, but it never really plays very well, any of this. But his final speech, which is called the malaise speech on this issue, really falls flat after a few days. Americans are frustrated that he's not leading, he's preaching to them, and they want someone to lead them out of the mess.
They don't want somebody sort of lecturing them on their morality when it came to energy and, you know, telling them to turn down their heat. They wanted somebody to reassure them that they would have heat.
Right. And there were also many politicians who weren't open to some of the policies he did propose. Many people didn't want to push for conservation. They didn't think American constituents wanted that. In the Northeast, many Democrats didn't want to take on the measures that he wanted because it would mean higher fuel prices for them. So it was a really complex policy, but equally important, he wasn't someone who could put it together in a politically appealing package. So he faced a difficult situation, and he didn't do a lot with it.
But was he right? You know, we're now looking at all these questions about energy, and everybody's recycling and everybody's trying to cut back on use. We have drought in California where people are using less water. I mean, people have a sense now that they have to be more conservationist when it comes to their energy.
There were a lot of issues he was on top of early on. I mean, energy and energy conservation was one of them. He was one of the first presidents to really talk about human rights and the need to make human rights part of foreign policy, not just war. And, you know, he also was one of the strongest proponents of diplomacy as opposed to war. And over the long run, I think there's many Americans who agree that he was on to something important, even if he wasn't the person to implement it.
Well, and here we have him in his post-presidency, as you say, one that sort of rewrote the books on what it should be. Compare what he's doing to, let's say, the Clinton Foundation.
Well, certainly the controversial parts for some people will sour Carter to everyone. So if you don't like what he's doing on the Middle East, regardless of all his other work, you'll say, well, he's not doing so much. But in general, I think you have to at least admit that he has been committed to the role of trying to be an international world diplomat, whereas Clinton has been much more focused on fundraising, speeches, and politics, still a partisan politician. I don't think Carter really likes that, and I don't think he's been interested in that. He's really driven by his commitment to policy. And I think it's a big difference in how they've spent their years thus far.
And Julian, just a quick thought. Presidents are younger. Look at Barack Obama. And people are, in general, living longer. Do you see a possibility that a president might leave office and not do anything? I guess part of that question, are you and others waiting to see what George W. Bush does?
My suspicion is he might become more involved over time. I think when you have younger presidents, you're just going to see, especially in the post-Carter world, that at some moment, if not throughout their post-presidency, they're going to remain engaged and active political players. But that can mean different things. So you might have a Carter model, you might have a quieter model like George W. Bush, or you might have a more political model like Bill Clinton.
That's Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. We've been taking a look at Jimmy Carter, who just made headlines recently for not feeling well. And our reaction was, well, but still, he's traveling around the world at 90, more than most. By the way, Julian's latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society. Julian, thanks as always.
Thank you.
It's well known that panda bears have a huge appetite for bamboo, but scientists have discovered that pandas' vegetarian diet might be leading them to extinction. The findings were published yesterday in the journal MBio. Joining us in the studio is our resident animal expert, Vicky Croak, who writes WBUR's The Wildlife blog and also wrote a book about pandas called The Lady and the Panda. Vicky, welcome back.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And haven't pandas been eating bamboo for millions of years?
That's right. And we always knew that the giant pandas have the plumbing of a carnivore, but the diet of an herbivore. And now we know that their digestive system is even worse than we thought. Their stomachs and intestines are not longer like that of herbivores, especially constructed for plant material. But some scientists thought at least they must have some microbes to help. And it turns out they don't. Animals who eat what they're built to eat, like lions or deer, they can absorb like 80 to 90% of the nutrients they're taking in. For pandas, it's like 17%. So they have to eat a lot, like 30 pounds a day. They have to conserve their energy, and they have to eat for many hours.
So how did they become vegetarians in the first place then, given that?
Well, this is a big question. We don't really know the answer to that, and we're guessing when we say this, but bamboo is plentiful, it's abundant, it's green, it's a consistent food source. So they can get at it all year. But why would they have switched over? We're not sure. What we do know is that in the wild, when there's more nutritious plants available in the summer, for instance, or in captivity, when we offer them meat even, they often ignore it. They want to eat bamboo. Hmm. And they do eat meat occasionally.
And that's what – so this study basically tells us what that's new that we didn't know already.
Well, so researchers in China gathered a bunch of giant panda fecal samples. And they did some DNA sequencing and analyzed it. And so they discovered that even though the pandas are eating like herbivores, that is the bulk of their diet is plant material, it's bamboo, the microbes in their gut are not like those in herbivores, but like the microbes in a carnivore's gut. And that's not good because plant material has tough cell walls, and you need some kind of biological trick if you want to get at those nutrients. So pandas have some adaptations that I want to tell you about. One is that they have very thick skulls and they have some modified teeth. Hmm. So we know that I'll say this for pandas. They're good chewers, Jeremy.
Yeah, they do seem to have sharp teeth, don't they?
They do.
Now, are we talking about all pandas here, or how many species of panda are there?
Well, it gets confusing because there are red pandas also. We used to think that they were related, but they're related more by name than they are by DNA. So when we think – and giant pandas now are in the bear family. For many years, we told people they were more closely related to raccoons, but they're bears. And one of the things that I really love about pandas is that they're always confounding us. I mean, these are animals who want to be left alone, solitary, but they've got this flashy coloring. We thought they had a tenuous grip on their existence, but they've lived for, as you said, millions of years, longer than modern humans have been around. And I think that this diet thing that we're talking about today is just part of that panda paradox.
Well, are there other animals that are in this same box that are vegetarian but are better suited actually genetically to be carnivores or vice versa?
I think giant pandas are pretty unique in this.
Hmm. What does this mean for the panda population? I mean, is this the reason, as we said in the intro there, that pandas' vegetarian diet might be leading them to extinction? Is it really that this is that much of the problem, that they're eating the wrong thing?
The authors point to that in the study. They themselves say that this could put them at a high risk of extinction. But I think if you were able to ask a panda in the wild what it means to her, she'd shrug her shoulders because they've been at the game for a really long time. And if we protect them and give them enough space, they'll get along just fine. I mean, it reminds me of we used to think that pandas had horrible sex lives. We had trouble getting them to mate in captivity. We know that they're only breeding for just a couple of days a year. But really, they do well with their mating behind our backs.
All right. I want to just ask you about one other topic that's in the news in the animal world that you've been looking at, and that is a move in Kenya to save endangered rhinos. Tell us what's going on.
As we're sitting here talking, 20 rhinos are on their way to a different area in northern Kenya. These are critically endangered eastern black rhinos. We're really working hard to save them. What I like about this story, what's happening right now as they're being moved, and there are four on the ground right now, is that the community in the Samburu County in northern Kenya is heavily involved in this move. They are welcoming the rhinos. They're going to be involved in protecting them. And they have a lot of big gun conservation groups behind them, the Kenya Wildlife Service and also Lewa Wildlife Conservancy, a group that I really love. They've got 100,000 acres in northern Kenya devoted to helping the eastern black rhino. They're a terrific group, and I've been there. And just as an offshoot, Prince William and Kate Middleton vacationed there, and I think sometime after that they were engaged. So it's a special place.
Well, I think actually Prince Harry, since we're talking about the royal family, is in Africa doing exactly this. He's dealing with endangered. If I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong about
that. You really are when it comes to what the royals are doing.
All right, Vicky Croak, the author of the... I was just because I was in London last week and I read the tabloid newspaper and it's all about the royals everywhere you go.
There you go.
Vicky Croak, author of The Lady and the Panda and who also writes for the Wildlife blog for WBUR. We're going to link you to that at our website, hereandnow.org. Vicky, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, which had nothing to do with our mention of the royals just now.
In the tabloids.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.